were very, very small, and I think that that might have facilitated a smaller panel as a decision-making agency in a rational way. But as this population's now grown and grown and grown, I think it's valid to consider alternative ways of arriving at these decisions by elected officials at the county level.
So the powers of our elected officials should decline with rising population?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starkovich, no, but I'll say this, if you have 90 legislators responsible for the divisions of the state, then each legislator, of course the Senate, the House of Lords is one, and then the House of Representatives is another, but each of you has, broadly speaking, 1/90th of the vote, and then we've got the big vote upstairs.
God or the governor?
On the other hand, on the county commission, how many people do you have to talk into to get a railroad? One, maybe two. It's really a lot more flexible politically the way the county commissions are organized. But I think you'll see what I'm getting at if you were to sort of controvert the positions and imagine if we had a decision-making body on the state level that was made up of 3 or 5 people.
Well, okay. So, I have no further questions.
Mr. Chairman, I think that we're dealing with this question about the panel. Somebody indicated here earlier that if the criteria for these changes in EFU use were fairly explicit, so that there was not, in effect, a substantive question being decided, but more an examination of the facts and applying it to these principles, then it would seem reasonable to have the hearings, the findings of the hearings officer, the final one, only subject to, in effect, judicial review. Can you imagine a situation in a industrial zone in which there might be that industrial zone has been set up, and there are requirements within that industrial zone, and providing for a panel or a hearings officer drawn from the owners or operators of industries in the industrial zones, trying to have a hearing to determine whether or not there should be some sort of a variance from the industrial zone. Would you think that following through, would you think that would be appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roberts, yes, I think it could be appropriate. I think if you're in an industrial zone, you're not going to have any more, if planning is properly carried on, and remember, planning is new, so we have circumstances now that might not work this way, but I think if planning is properly carried on over the years, in an industrial zone, you're not going to have the heterogeneous sorts of industries, which would create a substantial difference of interest among the people that occupied the zone. I don't think you'd have the kind of political conflict you have when you have substantially different kinds of activities going on in the zone, such as residential activities going on in an industrial zone, farming going on in an industrial zone, military activities going on in an industrial zone. I think that when planning is done rationally, the way it should be, you'll have a certain heterogeneous nature of the industries in the area, and I would think it would tend to direct their interests politically in a similar direction in that zone, i.e., for what was the greatest good for the members of the zone.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to but I think that I remember many years ago having the experience of finding a group that was strongly opposed to zoning, and I discovered that in my naivety I thought that they were opposed to regulations, and in truth they were opposed to the zoning process because they found that the governing body was constantly changing it to the advantage of somebody who was applying for a change, and that's what they were against. they would write an I-had zoning and have it all laid out and then find some political body would be responding to pressure from some individual to change the zone. And it seemed, as I recall, that was the case in Clackamas County of a group that opposed that. And so I think that there, I'm not sure, I have some uncertainty about this panel of farmers making decision for the county, but I think there's some, I see some validity into it, rather than having a political group decide whether or not they ought to waive the rules.
Mr. Chairman, may I make one, stress one thing I said earlier?
Yeah, very briefly.
Briefer
than the member of the committee.
Because of the different years that taxation principles were applied to small tracts with woodlands people, the different years that farm use assessments were developed and the different bodies, there is a sort of difference in the way the law regards small woodlands operators, designated forest operators, and farmers. That is really a matter of the law not seeing the essential unity of these operations than any real difference between them. And I think that the small woodlands operator would gain great advantages by being considered more as farmers are in exclusive farming zones for purposes both of assessment and in their responsibilities to the preservation of farm and forest land. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just if you had to pick out of this bill the one central section, the one central policy section, which would it be? Would it be the income test? Would it be the non-farm parcels, the panel? What would it be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starkovich, our policy is unequivocal. It would be the partitions and subdivision section, non-farm uses in the zones.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Grand Hut is a small farm woodland. Began talking, and so I went to look at the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Marianne Hutton, representing Associated Oregon Industries. I have also submitted some written testimony on April 15th on both the Senate Bill 234 and 237. Refuted those into the record, and just speak to two issues today: the decisions by an appointed farm panel and the standing provisions. As I think you've heard before by some of the other witnesses, the idea of having quasi-judicial decisions be made by an appointed panel of persons solely having personal or business interests in that particular subject without any further local appeal, I feel is, and the position of our association is, a complete reversal of Oregon's historic stand with regard to conflicts of interest and the opportunity to be heard by an impartial tribunal in these types of cases. Under current law, and it's a good law, no more than two members of a county planning commission may be from the same occupation or business. And also, there is an opportunity to appeal to the governing body. Now, also under present law, the county governing body does have the option of appointing one or more hearings officers. They also have the option of having that hearings officer make the final decision without appeal to the governing body. We feel this option should be retained, but it should not be mandated in the law. The proposed system would not eliminate any potential for abuse in our system. It would not guarantee that good or the right decisions would be made in farmland cases. It would not guarantee that farm decisions would be supported by any better evidence or any better findings in the record. These would still be being made by drafted by the planning staff or the legal counsel of the county. It would not depoliticize the decisions. It would simply put the decisions at a different level. It would not guarantee that this special interest panel would have any more of the public's interest at heart in making those decisions. And I think there's another important point, too. I'm speaking from experience on this one, and that is I was a county hearings officer, and I've heard and decided probably somewhere around 400 land use cases in that role. And that is giving the appearance of a conflict as opposed to the appearance, and in truth, a fair and impartial and thorough hearing of the matters. And whether win or lose, I think that was of primary importance to those people going through that system, is to have that sense that they had a fair hearing by someone who was impartial, who was not basing it on their own built-in biases, as we've heard, or their own built-in experience with that particular issue, but rather basing it on the evidence that was heard and the criteria and the standards that were to be applied. And I guess in response to some of the other testimony, I need to drive home the point that these are quasi-judicial procedures that we're talking about, not legislative, not rulemaking, quasi-judicial, where we have evidence and we have standards by which to judge the evidence, and we make findings on that basis, and we make a decision. I think if we lose that appearance of impartiality, we're going to just see further appeals by those people who feel disgruntled that they did not have a fair trial or a fair shake at the local level. So again, and particularly with regard to the arguments of standing, I think the same token we argue that these cases can affect farmland owners miles away, and that it causes them to be aggrieved or have a stake in the decision. If that's the case, wouldn't every decision that comes before that farm panel in some way affect the persons serving on that panel? Wouldn't they have a stake or an economic stake in that decision? I just don't think it's appropriate to our process for quasi-judicial decision-making in the state. With regard to the standing provisions, again, extending legal rights only to certain persons with a certain type of land or a certain occupation, not extending those same rights to other persons who might be similarly impacted, is arbitrary at best. I think our concept of equal protection under law implies that all litigants similarly situated may appeal to the courts under like conditions, with like protections. I think this provision can only encourage litigation and increase appeals. Apparently, the intent would also be to do away with the requirement to appear at the local level in these quasi-judicial land use cases, as is currently required. Again, I think it goes against the grain of our concept of having these quasi-judicial land use cases litigated by those parties who are affected by the decision, who have participated at the local level, and who are aggrieved or adversely affected by that decision. I think also with regard to the consolidation of partitionings, there are some problems with that concept as expressed in Section 13 of the bill. This is a different concept than simply consolidating or considering individual parcels as one parcel for the purposes of locating a dwelling. What Section 13 would seem to be trying to do is actually in some way legally consolidate those parcels back into one parcel. Whether or not they were legally divided under a proper partitioning standard. In other words, 2 years ago, someone came through the process, had the goals applied, or the local comprehensive plan applied at the time, got a legal partitioning, perhaps even went to the Land Use Board of Appeals and argued it there and won the case, and has a legal partitioning for all purposes, and simply because one of those parcels has not been transferred, are we now going to say all bets are off and it's time to go back through that process all over again? This is a different type of a concept, consolidating the parcels, actually, than simply saying at some point we're no longer going to allow dwellings on those parcels. How it would be done, whether we're getting the county involved in deeds and in recording instruments and all the rest, I think is fraught with problems. It could, in fact, I think, encourage a sooner conversion of some of those lands. People who feel that if I don't transfer those lands or develop them within 3 years, why I'm going to have to go through this process again and perhaps be converting those parcels sooner than I would be. So that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Okay, I want to take advantage of the fact that you're here and ask you something that isn't actually supposed to be discussed today, and that's you have the bill in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Bottom of page 7, section 6, subs 4 and 5, the sections dealing with non-farm parcels and subdivisions. Those were identified by the previous witness as the central core of the bill from their perspective. Have you found that lines 36 through 39?
Yes, I have seen it.
What are your opinions on those four lines?
Senator Starkovich and other members of the committee, I was not prepared to testify, obviously, in any depth with regard to those. My initial reaction is that not approving any further division of land in an exclusive farm use zone, in other words, just a minor partitioning or a major partitioning, which is either used or not used in conjunction with farm use, is going too far, because there can be legitimate divisions of land in exclusive farm use zones, simply based on my own personal experience. If you have good criteria, good standards, and you adhere to those criteria and standards, that should take care of that problem. With regard to not allowing subdivisions in an exclusive farm use zone, that is pretty much the law in at least many of the counties that I'm familiar with, and it was in Marion County when I was dealing with the land use laws there. A subdivision, the only difference being, of course, four or more parcels rather than two or three parcels. But at that point, you can get into a greater parcelization of land, and generally I wouldn't see the problem with that provision as much. Generally, these other partitionings we're talking about sometimes are for farm purposes or for a non-farm dwelling that may be appropriate under the standards in those unusual circumstances. Subdivision, when you're talking about four parcels or more, perhaps that's the appropriate dividing line.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Richard Benner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Benner with 1000 Friends of Oregon. I've got a couple of comments on three of the provisions that are up for discussion today. On the amendment to 215-185, which is at page 5, lines 10 through 15, this is the provision that would authorize an award of attorney's fees in certain circumstances. I think you've heard enough testimony from people in the position to know that it's very difficult, if not impossible, for counties to enforce the policies and the criteria in their EFU statute, EFU ordinances, for several reasons. One is that it takes time, and district attorneys have a lot of other things that they have to do and probably would rather do, and it's costly. The existing law authorizes citizens who are adversely affected to enforce the law, not just in EFU zones, but all county zones. But there's really not much incentive for them to do so because they've got to take the burden on themselves of paying the costs and the attorney's fees. And I bet if you looked around the state of Oregon, you could probably count on your hand the number of times in the past several years when this has been done. I think what Agriculture for Oregon is trying to do is simply to, if a farmer who's objecting to misuse of a temporary dwelling near his or her farm, that farmer is willing to do the county's job for it, shouldn't the farmer be made whole for having done that? Shouldn't the farmer be able to recover his attorney's fees or costs? Without that, there's really not much incentive for the farmer to spend the $5,000 or $6,000 to force proper use of a temporary dwelling that may be causing him a problem. It's probably causing him a problem that isn't worth $5,000 to him. It may be an irritant, it may cost him, he may have to take some unusual practices to prevent the dog from that house coming on and chasing a sheep or something like that, but it's not likely to be a $5,000 problem for him. If, in the limited circumstances that an award could be made in the amended Agriculture for Oregon language, there would be an incentive for the farmer to try to assist the county in enforcing the ordinances, and I think that's appropriate. Recall that we're not talking about awarding fees for bad land use decisions. We're talking about situations after the land use decision has been made. We're talking about an enforcement situation. I became aware of this problem last year when a farmer in Marion County, her name is Janice Butch, and she farms some land with her husband along the Pudding River. And the owner of a 40-acre parcel of cropland next door to her applied for and received a permit for a temporary dwelling for a mentally handicapped daughter several years ago. The permit was granted by Marion County appropriately, and for approximately 4 months, the handicapped daughter lived in the dwelling unit. Then the owner of the 40-acre parcel had the daughter removed to a state hospital, and then leased the temporary dwelling unit several years ago to some folks who lived in town, a young couple, and they have a dog, and they immediately started creating problems for the farmer. The farmer complained to the county, and the county said, yes, we think there is an enforcement problem here. We will look into it. Well, years have passed, and the county simply hasn't had enough time. Its attention is elsewhere. It's got budget problems. Hasn't been able to do it. And that farm operator has been plagued by the interference from misuse of that dwelling unit ever since. I think if this provision were in effect, that farm operator would have the incentive she needs to take care of the problem by herself without bothering the county. On the question of...
Sir, and if the case, if the plaintiff had brought a bad case to court, they would be risking losing their investment, wouldn't they? Would they not? since they would have to pay their own...
That's right.
...lawyer unless they won the case, so I think...
They'd still have to pay a lawyer.
Unless you're pretty rich, you don't go around losing money on bad cases.
I don't think there's any... I don't think there's any reason not to provide for attorney's fees to the respondent or to the defendant, because I don't think farmers or others would bring this case unless they have an awfully clear case. I think it would be very unlikely for somebody to embark upon litigation like this unless the case were clear. There wouldn't be much hazard of losing. On the farmers panel issue, I think the it's important to understand that the kind of decision that we're talking about delegating to a farmers panel, Marianne Hutton made this point, is not a policy-making decision. It's the application of existing policy, existing criteria, to factual circumstances. County elected officials, by and large, are elected to enact policy. They're not elected to act as judges. The only kinds of decisions that the farmers panel, or let's say a hearings officer, would be making here is decisions such as a land division or a non-farm dwelling in an exclusive farm zone, where the standards are set by and large in state law. That's one thing I think that distinguishes this situation from a panel to make decisions about the use of industrial land. The state of Oregon does not yet have standards in state law for the use of industrial land, not precise standards that are applied by hearings officer on a case-by-case basis.
Can I interrupt, Mr. Chairman? Why not? Why have a farmer do it? Why not have a professional hearings officer?
Well, that's a very good idea, and we supported that in the 1981 session. It was proposed on the House side this session in Representative Werner Anderson's bill on the general land use bill. It ran into problems. The chief reason, I believe, is that it costs money for counties to hire a hearings officer. Generally, they're either the eight or so counties that use hearings officers now hire planners or land use lawyers, and it's expensive. And I think that was the chief reason why the House committee didn't give that very serious consideration. The advantage here, of course, is that the farmers panel would act like volunteers on a planning commission. They would not be paid.
Mr. Chairman, could not then the objections to this that are raised would merely be to have a theoretically an impartial panel of hearings officers, but not just restricted to full-time commercial operators and so forth?
Well, I think, yes, I think another solution could be found. For example, you heard some objection from the Small Woodland Owners Association that there are small woodlands in exclusive farm zones. Wouldn't it be right to place a small woodlands owner on the panel? I think that's perfectly legitimate. Or perhaps someone else who has a different kind of interest in farmland. One of the criticisms that you've heard about this is that it seems to raise a conflict of interest. I think the people who make that objection aren't looking at the whole picture. Farmers have a countervailing interest in decisions made in an EFU zone. The suggestion is the farmers are going to turn down non-farm dwellings and land divisions because it's to their advantage to do that. But there's another way of looking at it, of course, and that is it's very much to the farmer's advantage, it could be, to approve land divisions and non-farm dwellings, because that puts them in a position of earning making quite a bit more money on their own land when it's time for when they choose to divide or apply for a non-farm dwelling. So there's a countervailing force here, I think, that may negate the conflict of interest that's been raised. Recall also that one statement was made that this reverses Oregon law, the policy in Oregon law, not to have more than one or more than two persons from the same occupation on a planning commission. We're not talking about a planning commission here. The planning commission, of course, would continue to exist and would continue to advise county elected officials on planning policy matters. We're only talking about a panel that's acting as a hearings officer. There's nothing that would prevent any citizen from the county from serving on the planning commission. We're just talking about a hearings officer here. Finally, on minor partitions, This is a provision that I think has been necessary for some time, that is, requiring counties to regulate minor partitions. There are, most counties do this, several counties don't. Tillamook County is one that does not. There's an awful lot of very good dairy land in Tillamook County, subject right now to the following sequence of events. A dairy farmer decides to retire, sells the 50 or 60 acre dairy to someone who's not interested in continuing operation of the dairy. That person can go into the assessor's office right now and divide that dairy into three 20 acre parcels without any regulation by the county. The county never gets a chance to look at it and say, maybe you shouldn't do that. The very next year, that same landowner can come in and take those 20s and divide each 20 into
three
more parcels. At the end of 2 years, that 60 acre dairy is now in nine parcels, and the county has no regulatory authority over that, except to deny a building permit to the owner, the innocent purchaser of one of those parcels, when that person comes in for the building permit. Well, that's a terrible way to regulate it, and of course, it's very difficult for a county to say no at that point. Isn't it much better to regulate the creation of the parcels in the first place? Also, this change would make the subdivision law consistent with what 215.263, that's the land division provision in the exclusive farm use statute. This would make the subdivision law consistent with that statute. That statute right now today says any division of land in an exclusive farm use zone should have the approval of the county governing body. So the two provisions of law are now inconsistent, and it results in conflicting advice from lawyers to counties, from the Attorney General's office to LCDC about whether a county has to have a minor partition ordinance in place. Certainly the change should be made to make those two provisions of law consistent. That's all that I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Barron? Thank you very much. Genevieve Barron?
My name is Genevieve Barron. I'm from Route 1 Monroe in Benton County. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have a very brief testimony today because I am really opposed to this, the amendments to this bill and the bill in toto, so I will try to be very brief. The item advocating that counties pay court costs is too ludicrous to even deserve discussion. Counties cannot meet all of their needs now. An added strain is unthinkable, even if the idea were sound, which it isn't. Land use laws are already divisive in the extreme. Encouraging neighbors to run around spying on neighbors is unthinkable in anything except a police state. It's been our experience in our county that the same people are the ones that challenge every decision and bring each thing into court. I'm already frightened when I hear someone tell this group that what was originally intended when something was written. The phrase minimum lot size appears in several instances in the bill. That could be appropriate in counties whose comprehensive plan uses that concept, but since LCDC has said that minimum sizes are not a requirement, the phrase shouldn't be used in state encompassing measures. Section 7.3 must not be enacted. It places all power in the hands of a few to the possible detriment of many. Section 8.1b gives them power even over the elected body. Small and part-time farmers must not be ruled out of decisions. In spite of a generalization given in previous testimony here that small operators don't know what they're doing, there are some very intelligent and conscientious people out there contributing their part to the farm economy. Berries taste just as good coming from a $2,000 crop as from a $20,000 crop. And believe me, the thing would get into politics in the election of the governing body who would appoint this very elite group. We do not need the board and one more layer of bureaucracy. That also brings up the use of the word commercial, and it has been already brought up here before today, and the need to define it. IRS considers any income from farm products as commercial and subject to tax. At least I pay tax on my income, which doesn't reach $20,000. Mr. Benner's statement that there are plenty of places out there for small operations is probably correct, but they're not always available. Across the road from me is 80 acres of Weyerhaeuser timberland. It's zone rural residential 5. It's not available for someone to buy to put a small operation on. Mine is not for sale either. Now, if Mr. Benner would just allow people to occupy some of the places that are out there so that there'd be no quarrel. Which brings up lots of record. I believe that parcels legally created and carrying a dwelling right should remain so. In fact, if that kind of a lot of record had been passed originally, we wouldn't have all these hassles that are coming up today. In 1966, my husband and I bought 10 5-acre lots. His insurance had been canceled.